He's a former CIA operative and says the greatest danger to America may not be recruiters from ISIS, but hackers from China. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. Just download our WJCT app and listen anytime. Just ahead, we speak with Panavedra author and former CIA operative T.L. Williams on the global threat of cyber hacking. Got questions? Call us up now, 549-2937. Then later, Cole Pepper on a rare weekend for him without football. Plus, exciting news as our local music show, Indie Endeavor, teams up with 1904 Music Hall. We'll tell you about that. All of that and more ahead. But first, this hour, there's so much to be concerned about right now, whether it's illegal immigration, a potential nuclear attack from Iran or North Korea, gun violence, the growth of terrorism abroad and here at home. But what if, in this year of outrageous politics, government leaders are overlooking an even more insidious peril to our national security? What if the greatest danger to America isn't recruiters from ISIS, but hackers? Not from Russia, but China. CIA veteran T.L. Williams, he's a local author, unfolds this chilling and highly conceivable scenario in his latest novel, Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. He joins us now in studio to talk about the global threat of cyber hacking, and he takes your calls. T.L. Williams, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me this morning.
Thanks for being here. And here's our question to callers. Whether it's hacks from Russia or China, what are your questions for former CIA veteran and First Coast author T.L. Williams? The number to call in about this is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. Now, in a moment, we'll talk about the plot of Zero Day. But first, I have to ask you, this really caught my eye because we're hearing a lot about how Russia has hacked this country, hacked the Democratic National Committee, used cyber hacking techniques to affect our U.S. election. We'll talk about that, but in your book, you talk more about the threat of China's cyber hacking, which most Americans aren't as aware of, right?
Right. Chinese cyber hacking against the U.S. has been going on for decades. And I was recently, while I was doing some research for the book, I saw a comment from an economist who said that the net result of China's cyber hacking against the U.S. is the largest transfer of wealth in history.
And how much money are we talking about? How is China doing this?
Hundreds of billions of dollars. And they do it through just insidious, persistent phishing attacks and more sophisticated attacks against the government, against private institutions, and against individuals.
And they steal data from Americans, proprietary information from businesses, think tanks, defense contractors, the government, individuals, right? All of the above?
All the above. You know, when I lived in China, I became aware that China was basically a surveillance society. We were surveilled constantly while we were there, from the time we left our apartment in the morning to the time we got home at night. And I think with the advent of technology, it just gives China a different and new way to basically surveil.
Surveil this country. We're speaking with CIA veteran T.L. Williams about his new novel, Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. What are your comments and concerns about how other countries are hacking the U.S.? It's 549-2937. And so in your book, you talk about this in a fictional plot that could be a real-life plot. Let's talk about the plot of Zero Day.
Well, the fictional aspect of Zero Day is that I have posited that the Public Security Bureau under the Ministry of Public Security is mounting these attacks against the U.S. In reality, in China, it's the 2PLA that does cyber attacks against the U.S. So that part of it's fictional. But I have a protagonist who has been a leader in two other books that I published, Logan Alexander. He's forward deployed as a CIA officer to Hong Kong, where he is prepared to do covert action and kind of a case officer on steroids. And a Chinese volunteer reaches out to the U.S. to let the U.S. know, advise the U.S. that a major cyber effort is underway to take down the U.S. economy. And the plot unfolds with Logan eventually contacting this volunteer, and between the two of them figuring out a way to squash the thing.
To squash the whole thing. And so this is a plot that you came up with from your real life experiences in the CIA. How long were you with CIA and what did you do for the agency?
Well, I had a 30-year career at the CIA. I went in the early 1980s and elected to receive Chinese language training and kind of spend most of my career in Asia with a focus on China because I thought that was where all the action was going to be. Yeah. I was a senior operations officer. Operations officers' roles are to recruit spies and produce intelligence. So that's what I did for 30 years.
So you were a spy?
No, I was an intelligence officer.
So what's the difference?
The difference is that, at least in the vernacular, we call the people that we recruit spies or agents.
Yeah.
We call ourselves operations officers. Other people call us spies.
Or spooks, even.
Or spooks,
right? Spooks, yeah.
Yeah.
The number to call in and chat with our local spook, ex-spook, T.L. Williams, is 549-2937. And so this is a fascinating plot in your novel Zero Day, how China is literally extracting billions of dollars from our economy simply by geeks going on the internet and stealing data on behalf of the Chinese government. You believe the biggest threat to our security in this century is in cyberspace. How could a potentially deadly attack on this country come, whether it's from China or Russia or another hostile foreign power?
Well, I believe it really poses an existential threat. You know, a lot of the other threats that we face today, the terrorist threats, they're not at that level. They're unfortunate. You may lose 20 or 30 people in a terrorist attack, which is a terrible thing. But China has the ability, and we see it in the kinds of probes that they do, to come in, for example, and shut down gas pipelines. They do probes to do that. They practice it. And if at some point they decided they want to shut down gas deliveries in the cold of winter and make it impossible for people to get necessary fuels, that could pose a serious problem to us.
And because they don't have the same level of military power, economic power, although they certainly are gaining on us, your concern is that as China seeks world domination, they could attack our banking system.
Exactly. You know, and this was actually a comment that was made by a senior advisor to President Bush right after 9/11. He said, as bad as 9/11 was with that horrible image that we all have in our mind about those towers coming down, a more catastrophic event would have been if they had actually hit our financial networks. That could have really hurt us.
And what would be an example of a country doing that to the U.S.? How could you paint a picture for us how that would play out?
Well, in New York, for example, where a lot of those financial data resides on servers and networks, if you were just simply to take all that out and banks couldn't communicate with each other, couldn't communicate with all their customers, it would just create a catastrophic sense of unease about our banking, and there might be capital flight outside of the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your expertise is China, but I want to ask you a little bit about Russia. We continue to learn more about how Russia hacked our presidential election and allegations of collusion between Vladimir Putin's Russia and President Trump and his circle of advisors. If you were still in the intelligence community and you had access to the information that they now have, how do you see the intelligence community handling this very sensitive matter that seems to be growing in concern?
Well, I think there would be great unease. As the intelligence community unfolded its report on the Russian hacking against the U.S. elections, I think there were about three reports put out, three levels of sensitivity in those reports. And we saw, obviously, the most open one that didn't have the greatest level of sourcing. So I'm not really sure what they had at the highest levels. But I think you would have to refer that to the FBI for follow-up investigation.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't sit on anything like that. And the FBI would take the lead on running those things down. And if they found that there had been criminal activity, they would have to pursue that.
They would have to. How would that be pursued?
In the courts.
Mm-hmm. And how likely do you think that is?
I think it's very likely, given some of the revelations that have come out in recent weeks.
You saw a lot in your career with the CIA. Before we went on the air, you said you really feel we're in uncharted waters now when it comes to these types of threats.
Right.
That's a big concern. I don't think most Americans have fully processed that. We're more worried about other things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how do you deal with allegations that that the president and some of his closest advisors are colluding with the Russians even before the election, and that even now these kinds of things may be taking place? I'm sure a lot of people are very chary about those allegations, and we should be careful that they're not just being made by oppositionists, but run them down, follow the facts. That's what I would do, follow the facts. And if the facts point to something untoward, then you need to take action against that.
And do you think there is any concern that some of these allegations that are being leaked out, we're seeing a lot of leaks coming from the intelligence community in the first few weeks of the Trump administration. How much of that is motivated, do you think, by political concerns as opposed to national security concerns?
Well, I've heard allegations that some of the leaks are emanating from the intelligence community, and that that has happened in the past. I don't know for sure if that's what's happening or what the motivation might be for that. You have to remember that the current director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, was appointed by Donald Trump, and he's going to do his best to get a tight grip on any leaking. I know when I was at the CIA, if there was any hint that anyone had been talking to the press out of school, they would be in really big trouble.
Big trouble.
Right.
Now, speaking of the CIA, they vetted your book for months before they allowed you to publish it.
Years.
Years.
It was 2 years.
2 years of extreme vetting, to quote the president. So why were they so concerned about what you were going to reveal in Zero Day?
Well, you know, that was a big question. As we went through the process, there was an appeal process, multi-level appeal process, and they were really eager to see me just put this in the bottom drawer and forget about it. And at the time, I could not get an answer out of them. Subsequently, I think what I concluded was that right around the time it would have come out in 2015, former President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping were concluding a no-hack pact. And the agreement was that they would, both sides would not target economic targets in their respective countries. And so this book, which is highly critical of China, would have been coming out right when that pact would have been going into effect. So it would have been somewhat embarrassing.
I see. Okay. Before we go to the calls, and the number to join us is 549-2937. This is a concern, I think, for so many Americans, concern that our data isn't private, that there is no privacy anymore online. What do you recommend people do to be more aware of this issue and be prudent about protecting their personal and business data?
Well, I think one of the things that people can certainly do is be alert to phishing attacks. They've become very sophisticated about how they phish. They have your private information, and so they can craft an email that seems completely natural. The other thing that you can do is you can take anything that's really sensitive that doesn't need to be accessible from the internet and keep it off the internet. Keep it on a disk, keep it on a standalone computer or something like that. And this not only goes for private individuals, but for corporations and for the government as well. Those are the main ways that you're going to be able to thwart hackers.
All right, let's go to your calls now for ex-spook T.L. Williams, the CIA veteran, now lives on the First Coast, and he's the author of a new book, Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. By the way, he's working on another book. We'll ask him about that in a minute. But first, let's go to your calls. As we talk about cyber hacking, it is a global threat. It is a threat to our national security, much more than we might realize. It's 549-2937. Chuck is at the beaches. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. You being in the business you were in, would you please explain to us the reciprocal of this? Angela Merkel, Germany, her phone. Would you please explain to us why the Israeli government was furious with the Obama administration for interfering in their election? You can pull it up and look at it on YouTube. And it strikes me as this is probably being done by everyone. And the idea that We're not doing it as well as what we do in Germany and Israel and all around the world, and we've probably been doing this since you were in the business. This is going on forever, and I'm assuming, if you want to call it a level playing field, we're doing the same thing. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. Yeah, what about that? Fair allegation?
I think that is a fair allegation. The sacrosanct relationships are the Five Eyes relationships, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, the U.S. And what's the other one?
You're supposed to know that.
I'm supposed to know that one.
You're retired.
Right. And so with those particular countries, there is a tacit agreement that we do not spy on each other. And I, although it's not really widely talked about, all nations spy not only on their adversaries but on their friends. So I think it's it's indisputable, and I don't think it's something that we can really argue about.
Yeah, the Five Eyes. By the way, Google tells me the Five Eyes are Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and the US.
The UK, of course.
When Donald Trump had a kerfuffle with the head of Australia, there was concern that he was disrupting the solidity of this Five Eyes international security agreement. What do you think about that?
Well, it sounds like they had a kind of a brusque conversation, and it mostly dealt with the fact that President Obama had made an agreement to resettle a number of refugees here that the Australians couldn't handle. And so I think Trump was taking issue with that, and
yeah,
that's where the conversation went downhill. But no, that's a strong relationship, and I think both sides are pretty much pledged to keeping it strong.
It's 549-2937 to connect with T.L. Williams. Peter on the West Side. Hi, Peter. Hey, Peter, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
The one common denominator that is involved with all of these issues, which not only is other foreign governments, but companies, our own government, is it's the internet. And anything that is connected to the internet is not secure. And I know people just want to dismiss this and say, oh, well, that's the way it is. But it's convenience. We are giving up security for convenience. The idea that that anyone can shut down a utility from somewhere else, to me, is just anathema. Why on earth would you connect something that you don't want someone to sabotage to an internet which cannot be secured? I think until we wrap our minds around the fact that if you want some kind of physical security, don't connect it to the internet in the first place.
Thanks, Peter. What about that argument?
Well, when you think about it, when the internet first came online and when we were first using computers, we were all sitting at home with a desktop. Nowadays, we're walking around with multiple devices on our person, laptops, iPads, or smartwatches, cell phones. That all connect to the internet. And people have this notion that they still are entitled to and have privacy, but they don't have privacy. So you make a really good point, Peter. I think people have to, first of all, take ownership of that security problem, as I discussed earlier. And anything that's sensitive and doesn't need to be connected to the internet shouldn't be.
Do you think the average American should be worried that we are being spied on through our social media sites and all our online activity by our own government, as Edward Snowden and others have said?
Well, what happened, and this goes back to 9/11, when President Bush, with Congress, enacted the Patriot Act, and gave enhanced capabilities for collecting that kind of information to the federal government, and rather to law enforcement and police. And although much of that expired in 2015, it was renewed again in the Freedom Act, and those authorities are still there. So we don't want to handcuff police and law enforcement from doing their real jobs, but I think there needs to be a balance on that collection so that we don't feel like we're in a surveillance state.
Let's go to Bob on the South Side. Hi, Bob. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, pretty soon. Can I ask my question
now?
Yep.
Oh, please. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question is pretty direct. Last year, it was notified for 22 Americans, government employees, contractors, et cetera, that their identity had been stolen possibly by the Chinese government. Where do you think that's going to go? You think the Chinese are going to sit on it for a while and then leak it or sell it? Or, you know, I mean, that's a pretty big bombshell that could occur sometime in the future.
Well, if you go back to 2015, the Chinese stole over 20 million records from OPM. And so what are they planning to do with that? And it's anybody's guess. It is a problem. I can see how one scenario where counterintelligence officials in China might use that information, which included things like fingerprints and background investigation reports and DNA and all kinds of things, to craft those kinds of attacks I was talking about earlier, where they can do a phishing effort or go after somebody that they think may be vulnerable because of something going on in their life and try to recruit them.
It's your contention that China has hundreds of, if not covert agents, people functioning on behalf of the Chinese intelligence world here in this country.
Well, it's a fact that there are Chinese intelligence officers who are not assigned to any official mission in the United States operating in the U.S. at any given time. A lot of them are on the West Coast because that's where a lot of the high tech is, and they're out there plumbing that in Silicon Valley.
And before we go back to the phones, a few more points from your book. And by the way, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with former CIA operative and author T.L. Williams. He lives here on the First Coast now. His novel is Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. Given that China is so aggressively attacking us through cyberspace, do you see their currency eventually overtaking the dollar as you know, the currency against which all others are matched? I mean, is that a concern for our economy, our banking system?
You know, I don't think in the near term that's something that we have to worry about. But what is very real, and you can see it, is China's making moves to strengthen its currency. One of the things it's done in the last 5 years is go from dollar-denominated accounts with its trading partners to make them more renminbi, which is the name of the Chinese currency accounts. And so the dollar is being taken out of play in a lot of trade that China's doing. China has also felt for a long time that it doesn't have a rightful place in the world economic order, that the U.S. and sort of an old boys school from post-World War II have that. And they have succeeded in having the renminbi in a basket of currencies now that the World Bank acknowledges as reserve currencies.
What about Donald Trump, President Trump's vow to declare China a currency manipulator?
Well, it's a fact that China's a currency manipulator. I mean, the renminbi was pegged at about 8.5 to the dollar for years. They didn't allow it to float. I think it is floating a little bit more these days. But they do have used that to their advantage in the past.
And we have a lot of emails for you, T.L. Williams, from some very informed people, by the way. Good job, First Coast. You're really following this well.
Right.
Here's one from Ed. He's an InfoSec professional. He writes, given the weak patent laws within China, isn't the manufacturing in China a major blow to the economy with regard to the transfer of knowledge required in the manufacturing process?
Well, I can remember in the days when I was in China, in Shanghai, McDonnell Douglas used to bring in kits to build MD-11 aircraft there. And nobody wanted to have the Chinese manufacturing anything in China because, you know, they would just steal the intellectual property. So they have been known for years, and I think that's one of the big reasons that they hack. And a lot of the theft that we talk about is intellectual property that goes out the door, out the window here, you know, hacking from the U.S.
Here's a few questions from John at the Beaches. How does the U.S. consider and weigh response policy options to Chinese hacks directed by the PLA or other government agencies?
Well, most recently, I think you can look back a couple of years ago when I think four or five subpoenas were issued against PLA officers who had been proven to have been involved in hacking in the United States. That's the most stringent sort of response that I've seen from the U.S. government. Other than that, you know, we really haven't done much.
Here's another question from him. We are a Navy town, and he wants to know, does it make sense to build out a Navy that is not just susceptible to land-to-sea missile attacks, but also cyber hacks that can disrupt air and sea communications?
Well, I think there's always a threat that China's going to be going after our most sensitive communications, and the ones that you just highlighted are certainly fall within that realm. I think the response is that we have to have, Cyber Command, which has the responsibility of protecting all the military cyber networks, has to be beefed up. It has to get the kinds of resources that it needs and has to stay on top of it.
Okay, so with all of that said, Zero Day is out now. It's the full title of this book is Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. Are you doing any book signings around town? People can meet you.
Well, this week I actually have two scheduled. I'm going to be in Neptune Beach at the Bookmark. That is Thursday the 16th at 7 p.m. I'll be doing a talk there, and we'll have a book signing. And then Saturday I'll be at the San Carlos Bookstore from 10 to 2 doing a book signing. So come on out and look forward to seeing you.
He's Panavedra's own T.L. Williams, former CIA operative and author of Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. So fascinating to speak with you. What an incredible resource for our community. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Much more still ahead later. Our own independent music show, Indie Endeavor, is teaming up with 1904 Music Hall. We'll tell you about it. But up next, how the local firm Tap Immune is making strides in breast cancer treatment. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Coming up on 1A, what's next for the Democrats? The party is out of power in Washington and in two-thirds of state legislatures. Should progressives oppose the Trump administration all the way? Should they pick and choose their battles and compromise? And how might they win back voters who once supported the New Deal and put their hope in the nation's first black president? That's next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
10 houses of refuge were built in Florida between 1876 and 1886 to help shipwreck victims. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Sandra Thurlow about her book on the U.S. Life-Saving Service. We'll discuss the Florida History Conference cruise from Miami to Key West and Cozumel and a bicentennial exhibit. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville-based Mayo Clinic is currently undertaking a large study looking at triple-negative breast cancer funded by the U.S. Department of Defense. Here's also what's exciting. The local company Tap Immune is playing a major role as they supply Mayo with the TP4-200 vaccine. There is more important news to share as we talk about this emerging field of immunotherapy and the treatment of cancer. Glenn Wilson is the CEO of Tap Immune, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having us.
And to our callers, what are your questions about the promise of immunotherapy in treating breast cancer and other types of cancer? It's 549-2937. Tap Immune is just doing incredible things in this field. You have a lot on your plate. Can you bring us up to date?
Yes, we licensed two technologies from the Mayo Clinic and are working closely with them, one for HER2-new breast cancer and the other for triple-negative and ovarian cancer. And we've taken those through phase one studies, which is essentially a safety study. But exciting developments in both of those studies, over 90% of the patients that were treated showed a very strong immune response in relationship to the vaccines that were given. So they're responding as we'd hoped.
And so the holy grail, I guess, of cancer treatment is to come up with a vaccine that will actually work. How much closer are we to that, given the progress you're seeing with this kind of clinical trial?
I think we're getting closer for two reasons. First of all, we're getting smarter in the way we design vaccines. In the current studies, the vaccines were not taken or derived from animal studies. They were designed from looking at the patient's own immune system and their response in certain cancers. And that led to the, you know, to the selection of the components of the vaccine. I think the second thing is the rapid development of immunotherapy as a field.
Yeah.
We're now seeing, for example, the checkpoint inhibitors like Opdivo, like Keytruda that are now on the market, showing great promise. But it's clear that they're not going to get to the Holy Grail on their own. Uh-huh. They're going to need other things, like a vaccine. And so I think we're now well positioned in the field to look at combinations with other things like the checkpoint inhibitors.
Is your goal to develop a vaccine that works, say, the way Dr. Jonas Salk had the incredible breakthrough with the polio vaccine? Is that the goal here?
Clearly, that's the ultimate goal, is to have a prophylactic vaccine, a preventative vaccine. But, you know, given the nature of this field, you have to walk before you can run.
Yeah.
And so you're going to be developing a therapeutic vaccine. And in our case, we're looking at patients, ovarian cancer or breast cancer patients, that after they've been treated with surgery or chemotherapy, are at very high risk of recurrence.
Mm-hmm.
And the more times they recur, the worse the prognosis is. And so what we're doing in our current phase two clinical trials is looking at those sort of patients that have gone through frontline therapy and then looking at whether we can increase the time to recurrence or even prevent recurrence.
And can you explain a little bit more about how this therapy works to stimulate the patient's immune system to defeat the cancerous cells?
Yes, it's been known for a long time that the immune system can destroy disease, like, for example, bacteria, viruses. What we're doing is look, and it has a surveillance role, to continuously go around the body looking for foreign cells, foreign agents. What we're doing is providing the immune system with the signal, the target, which is overexpressed on the majority of the cancer cells we're treating. And so what we do is simply provide the vaccine. It's a simple injectable product, like a flu shot.
Uh-huh.
And then we stimulate the immune system to go and seek out that target, wherever it is. And we know that. We know from the phase one studies that the immune systems of those patients who were treated is actually doing that, is responding. What we're now doing in phase two is showing how that works clinically.
I see. And how much promise is there for the patients that are lucky enough to be in one of your clinical trials?
I guess we'll see with the results.
Yeah, you're still waiting to find out.
We're waiting. It's a long process.
How long?
Well, we'll be getting some interim data this year in two trials that we're doing. And the reason for that is these are what are called open label trials. So we know who's got what component, whether it's placebo or the vaccine. One of those trials is at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And we're doing a combination therapy there with our vaccine, TPIV-200, and AstraZeneca's checkpoint inhibitor, durvalumab. That's in patients, ovarian cancer patients, that have failed all other therapies.
Wow, incredible.
And so we should be able to see an interim results probably second half of this year.
People might not realize that this incredible resource is based right here in Jacksonville, Tap Immune. How can people, I'm sure many people listening might have a loved one who wants to join a clinical trial. How can they go about that?
I think the simplest way is simply to go onto our website, and we have a list of all the clinical studies in progress and contact information for people. That's www.tapimmune.com.
TapImmune.com, based right here on the First Coast. Just incredibly exciting news. They are on the leading edge of the field of immunotherapy and the treatment of cancers. And we're so pleased to have you back on the program. Please keep us posted.
Thank you very much.
Glenn Wilson is the CEO of Tap Immune. Again, to join a clinical trial or learn more, go to their website, TapImmune.com. And we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Advertisers and marketers already track our shopping behavior online, but businesses are now tracking our behavior elsewhere through apps on our phones.
They track how you're walking through the store, where you are, and can even change the price on goods.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joseph Turo about his new book, The Aisles Have Eyes. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor, Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone creating their own life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. Sponsored in part by AARP Real Possibilities.
Bright lights.
Welcome back. Well, it was a weekend without football. Without football! For the first time in half a year.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
All of us here in the 89.9 newsroom were very concerned about Culpepper's mental state throughout this horrible weekend, but he somehow made it through. And he joins us now. Good morning.
I'm just barely...
hanging on.
Hanging on by a thread.
Yes, I figured as much.
Well, so no football, no Super Bowl, no college football championship, no NFL. Somehow, though, here we are on a Monday. For the first, let's talk college basketball. We're not quite to March, but we've got a couple of months, a week, so we get to the madness of March. But
that's right.
For the first time, the NCAA Basketball Tournament Selection Committee released their top 16 seeds over the weekend. Kind of a preview of where things might go when the big dance is rolled out and everybody starts breaking down their office brackets. Florida State was a number 2 seed. Florida, a number 3 seed in those.
Very
both
nice.
Very respectable. Florida State proceeded to lose the game that day to Notre Dame on Saturday. The Gators, however, won their 20th game of the season. And I will say this is one of the best combined seasons for Florida and Florida State basketball in a long, long time. Both should have a chance to contend and go deep into the NCAA basketball tournament in March. Of course, we do have some time before we get there. There is a sub-regional that will be played in Orlando this year, so it's conceivable that both Florida and Florida State could play their first and second round games where, you know, next to each other, right down the road in Orlando.
Oh, cool.
Which would be a great draw, I think, for that sub-regional.
Very cool.
So, all right, there's basketball.
Uh-huh.
We're getting close to soccer starting. Last week, the Armada announced that they'd be playing their regular season matches at Hodges Stadium at UNF. Going to be a different environment, but it should be a real financial benefit to the club compared to playing at the baseball grounds. Change out costs to put a soccer field in were prohibitive, quite
right,
frankly.
Right, sure, yeah.
So that's going to be a benefit there. This is also a transitional season for the club, as owner Mark Frisch sold the team to the North American Soccer League, who are looking for new ownership right now. The Armada will be opening up their third season in April.
And you think Hodges Stadium will be a good place to go see them play?
Yeah, you know, it's a fantastic surface. The playing surface is fantastic there. UNF plays their soccer games there. When, of course, it was really improved upon when the Super Bowl was here, and it was one of the practice fields for one of the NFL teams. So the surface is going to be tremendous. The one difference that it's going to be pretty obvious is that all of the stands are on one side at Hodges Field. It's really built as a track stadium. So it's on one side. You're not going to have that surrounded feel that you do in some soccer stadiums. Eventually, yeah. I think, in order for the Armada to really establish themselves and take that next step, they're going to have their own stadium.
Sure.
Now, that's down the road, something that, you know, of course, the city may have a part in, potentially, but I think that's a real goal for the club down the road.
How many large American cities have a standalone soccer?
Well, soccer-specific stadiums are starting to become a little bit more common, particularly in MLS, the top division. In the second division, you don't see it quite as often. There are a few. Usually, they're multi-use for a lot of city soccer and that sort of thing. In Raleigh, they have one. Cary, okay. North Carolina, right outside of Raleigh, is one that is certainly right there. Tampa Bay has converted their old baseball stadium into one, and there are others around.
All right, last but not least, Jordan Spieth, all the talk over the weekend. He's now in Tiger Woods territory.
Yeah, and you know, when he had his two majors and contended for a third a couple of years ago as such a young golfer, before his 22nd birthday, we started saying, is this guy the next Tiger Woods? And the answer is maybe. He joins Tiger as the only golfers in history to win 9 PGA Tour events before his 24th birthday, as he finished at 19 under par to win at Pebble Beach over the weekend. Tiger was one of the stories on the weekend as well, withdrawing from the tournament after the first round and bringing some conversation forward that he may never be the same again, as doctors have told him to skip the next two events, including one in Florida. Woods is currently ranked 674th in the world, believe it or not. Hasn't won an event since 2013, has not won a major in nearly a decade, so it appears that Tiger Woods may be done for all practical purposes.
Huh, wow. But what a career.
An amazing career, just never got to that 18 majors that he wanted to match Jack Nicklaus.
Well, we'll see you next week, and I know it's a kind of a sports drought for you, but you seem to be in fine form, so I'm very, very relieved to see that.
Doing my best to fake it.
He's Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter, at Cole Pepper. And finally, this hour, WJCT's popular music show, Indie Endeavor, and 1904 Music Hall in downtown Jacksonville are teaming up. They've announced a monthly partnership where the show will record live performances and interviews with 1904's musical guests. We're going to air these the second Tuesday night of every month. Now, this partnership will also include exclusive web content, even unedited footage, all recorded inside the 1904 downtown venue. Here with more, Ryan Bank, host of Indie Endeavor. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Melissa.
And Jason Honeycutt. He's the co-owner of 1904 and Spliff's Gastro Pub. Good
hey,
to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Congrats, you guys. This sounds really exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely a, you know, I think both of us are always looking for ways to include more and more local music in the stuff that we do. Obviously, 1904 always has a packed schedule of different bands that are either touring or local acts that are coming for their second or third time to play. And at Indie Endeavor, we're always trying to ensure that we have kind of the most authentic Jacksonville sound. And this just makes total sense.
So, Jason, tell us a little bit more about how this is going to work, because people that have been to see a live show at 1904 know how fun it is. What are we going to be hearing on the air?
So it's a little bit different than a live show. Unfortunately, we won't have the audience aspect, but you still get the great kind of live music vibe on the stage with the lights and everything. So we're going to have some great web content with some good video. The showcase of the local music and kind of giving them a platform to do their original music, and just kind of on a monthly showcase of what we have in the city.
And this is an extension of what you're already doing on Indie Endeavor, Ryan. It's really a gem of a show, one of the only places on the radio dial where people can hear music that is not part of a corporate lineup.
Right. Yeah. There's no genre distinctions necessarily. So we don't discriminate against genre. We have every type of genre. If it's indie music, if it's not on on a major label, it's stuff that we play. And what I've been trying to do since I took over for the show is to have more people on playing live music and doing live interviews instead of just a rotating playlist. What this partnership allows me to do is actually fill the entire hour show. Instead of having one artist for a short interview and a couple of songs, we can have multiple artists in person at 1904. And like I said, it's just partnership that makes a lot of sense.
And you brought some music with you to play.
Yeah, we have one little quick preview of a really popular band around town called Tomboy. They just released a new EP, and here's a part of it. And that's live.
Nice.
That was actually live in 1904 from last week. And Jason could probably tell you a little bit more of putting together the lineup that we had that that'll be on the show tomorrow night.
Yeah, so tomorrow night, of course, you just heard Tomboy, amazing local musicians, kind of the indie electro dance vibe. We got a really kind of rounded sound coming in tomorrow. Also, Master Radical, kind of a really fun, funky rock and roll, high energy band. And then some great songs from Jackie Stranger, solo acoustic artist, more singer-songwriter stuff. So like Ryan said, just no genre specific, pretty much any quality local artist. We're trying to kind of give them a platform and showcase what they do.
Now, Jason Honeycutt, the founder of 1904 and Spleef's Gastropub, which is right next door, your establishments are part of what's called the Elbow Downtown Entertainment District.
Yes.
You're part of that whole scene. How have you seen that grow over the past few years?
It's grown tremendously. It started out actually kind of as a joke amongst some of the other bar owners and bar hoppers of the area. And then some good friends of mine, Grant Nielsen and Trey Hebron, decided to take it on as a one spark project to kind of see where that would go. And it's kind of just grown into a life of its own. And we were able to brand a specific part of downtown as the entertainment district. It's growing right now. We got some great new things opening. The Five and Dime Theater, they just opened up over on Adams Street next to the former Borough Bar. Mm-hmm. The Calfer Chop House will be open soon. Bold City Brewery. We actually, 1904 and Spliffs just received a DIA grant for the retail enhancement to remodel our back patio. Another bar in the areas are kind of coming up on Bay Street. So it's fun. It's growing, you know.
It's nice to see WJCT partnering up with some of this energy.
Yeah, definitely. And it gives us a real opportunity to bring people the sound of 1904's Music Hall directly into their radio.
Absolutely.
And their earbuds.
Yeah. And now this is kicking off this month. Tell us a little bit more about when people can tune in to hear not only this partnership, but everything you have going on Indie Endeavor.
So it's a pre-recorded show that airs every Tuesday at 11 p.m. As you said, the second Tuesday of every month, just because it sort of worked out that way, will be just an hour long show full of live performances from 1904 and interviews. The first of this partnership will air tomorrow. There's a little bit of an extended interview with Jason and going through the history of 1904, and then there's an interview with each of the four acts that that I had a chance to record and meet, and we talk about everything from the local music scene to each artist's trends and influences. So look mm-hmm. out for that tomorrow night.
Very nice. Well, congratulations, you guys. I look forward to hearing the music. Thanks so much for sharing it with our listeners.
Thanks for having That's us. Awesome.
Ryan Bank is our own host of Indie Endeavor. Jason Honeycutt is the co-owner of 1904 Music Hall and Spleef's Gastro Pub. Listen for this partnership, evenings on 89.9. Speaking of music, Al Jarreau, a versatile vocalist who sold millions of records and won a string of Grammys for his genre-busting work in pop, R&B, and jazz, died Sunday in Los Angeles. Jarreau was 76. Al Jarreau performed many times over the years in Jacksonville at our Jacksonville Jazz Festival and had a lot of fans right here in this community. We're going to close with a little bit of Al Jarreau. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the music. And we'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Song that we love to sing. Every time we hear the music, and we're in this love together, we got the kind that lasts forever. Sweeter all the time.
midnight and candlelight. And ooh, it's so romantic. We got the whole thing working out so right. And it's just the way we planned it. We got the kind that lasts forever. Don't you know that we're in this love together? And like berries on the vine, it gets sweeter all the time.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.